a statement of collaborative practice. Okay, pick it up from there. We started a process of talking about how we work together as doctors and nurses. We had nurse practitioners, we had nurse anesthetists, we had clinical nurse specialists of various kinds, and we came out at the end with a statement of collaborative practice that we all agreed with, which was non-controversial. It said everybody has areas of expertise, and in the course of taking good care of patients, which should be why we're here, we should use whatever expertise we have, and we should recognize our limitations. And if a doctor wants to do something that a nurse knows more about, then he turns to her as the expert. Makes good sense. It made such good sense, it passed both of our representative houses and our professions here in the state. And we were instructed to take this statement to our national organizations and propose it as a statement of action nationally. We did this about a year and a half ago. And nursing had no problem with it, because it's what they've wanted all along. But when we took it to the AMA, practically it was tarred and feathered. We had to withdraw the resolution, because it would have been modified in such a way that would have been destructive rather than constructive. So we were literally roasted by our colleagues from Georgia, mainly, who believe this is a terribly important issue, and one in which medicine and nursing that medicine must preempt its role, and if we don't, then it's going to lose prerogatives in the future. And Georgia clearly had support to win. So we had to withdraw it and ignominiously come back and say, look, we tried, and the nurses understood, but they also understand one other thing, and that's that what the AMA does not govern what North Carolina does. So the fact that the AMA passes a rule that says nurses should act in this subservient way doesn't mean we have to do that here. And they trust us in that, so we're fine.
And in the development of this notion of collaborative practice, the doctors were an equal player in that community. It wasn't just PAs and nurse practitioners.
Yes. In fact, it was just doctors and nurses. PAs were not involved. But PAs knew about it because we told them about it at all stages. Deliberately, they were not there because this was not, we had no problems with the way PAs have always adopted the stance that they work under the supervision of the physician. This is a declared tenet of the group, but not so with nursing.
Having seen the nurses obtain this, there was then not a groundswell for PAs to deal with the same issue.
PAs seem relaxed about it, and which is fine. I think this is, the rank and file is relaxed about it. There are some PAs who I'm sure feel exactly the same way. We deal with that in an individual way. And I'll mention an example. And I've dealt with this over the past 20 years as it comes up. The medical board in the state will, for example, get very uptight about something that happened in a given community. And sometimes the PAs will call on me to go and give an opinion as to whether this is something that the medical board should worry about or not. And I usually do it, and I usually come back and say what I think. And usually the board usually goes along. Because they respect somebody that looks at it fairly objectively, and I think I do. One of them was a PA, and this is a good example, a PA in the city in the state, who ran an urgent care center. He began working with a doctor, but the doctor wanted out of this enterprise, so the PA bought the doctor's interest. He became the proprietor of this professional enterprise. Well, technically, the doctor is the one who has the professional responsibility, and the laws are written that the doctor has to have that responsibility. There is a way to do it, and the lawyers can figure it out anyway, and the way is to, the PA owns the business, but the doctor owns the practice, and the business can hire the doctor. So it can work, and this PA had arranged it with a good lawyer, so he met all the requirements of the law. But in reality, he owned the practice, and he went out and hired a doctor to come in and work with him. He hired a doctor from another state who came in, the doctor was quite good, the doctor was quite happy doing that. He was an older physician who came here to get a little time with his grandchildren, and he wanted to come and work a limited number of hours, and the PA allowed him to do that in the surgeon care center. He did a good job of supervising, he did a good job of reviewing charts, he did everything that was supposed to be done. The medical board was fretting over this issue. So I went down and wrote a report, pages in length, went over everything, told them what I found, and they looked at it and brought it to their lawyer. My opinion was he was doing everything he was supposed to do, and their lawyer agreed, so they let him keep going. They didn't like it, but in another situation, we had a PA who was an ex-military PA, and this group is a little unusual, in that many of the military PAs operate with a lot of autonomy. Many of them operated under battlefield situations, and they don't take as easily to supervision as some of their civilian counterparts. But it varies widely with the individual. But this was an ex-military corpsman who was working with a physician, and the physician became disabled. And I mean disabled, he was in the intensive care unit, and the PA was still technically working under it. And this physician obviously couldn't supervise what he was doing. And though the PA was technically taking his charts and discussing patients, it obviously wasn't happening because the physician wasn't capable of doing it. And we had to sort of call that one. So I guess I've sort of fallen into a role as the person within medical officialdom that can be called on by the PA profession and can advise them as a friend and give them advice. And I think it's worked well.
That is not an official capacity. You're asked to do this on a voluntary or consultative
basis? Well, actually, I'm on their medical advisory board. But it doesn't meet very often. And I'm the only one they call on. Now, yes, they have other people on their medical advisory board, and they will occasionally call on them when something official has to be done, but I usually am the only one.
And the reason you're called on it probably is because you're able to see things from both sides.
Yeah. And I've been around, and I know where the stumps are sometimes that are under the surface of the water, and you're going to run into trouble there.
And your standing is as solid with other physicians in the state as it is with PAs.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Well, anyway, that works.
Right.
So that's kind of been my role for the past 10 or 20 years. Again, I left my official role with the PA program, having any administrative responsibility for it, back in 1985. But I can say that there was a period of time in the early 80s when we were under fairly severe stress to cut the PA program back, because it was a time when there was a thought that there was going to be an excess of doctors, and there was certainly going to be no need for PAs. And if I had to say today, I'd say there's going to be a greater need for PAs than there's doctors, because they can deliver good quality medical care under the structure that they're utilized for at a cost that's far less than that of an MD. I think it is possible for an MD to work with four PAs and to produce good quality medical care at a very reasonable price, and I think that's going to be increasingly called on. I think the doctor's role in the future will change, and the PA may be the front line.
That's fascinating. Do you see this already happening?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Several places. My job for the past 10 years has been to, I've worked for the Medical Society Foundation, and I have, as my tools in my quiver, I have money. I can help a physician get started in a community by helping him pay his medical educational loans or supplement a salary or whatever. But I can also supplement a PA salary or a nurse practitioner salary. So what we have done is to go about, and my job is to go around the state and look at areas that need medical practitioners and do what's necessary to bring that practice there. And it may be a physician, it may be a PA, it may be a nurse practitioner, whatever. But we look at troubled medical communities. Troubled for two reasons. One is the community is poor. That's the usual reason. It can't afford a doctor, but it still needs a doctor. The second reason is that there's some medical dysfunction, malfunction. And many times this is the medical practice itself. The doctor may be a poor doctor. He may not be able to attract a partner because of his personality or whatever. He may not know how to work with other people. He may be a loner. Well, all of those occur. And my job has been to go in and sort of help diagnose the problem. And I work with other people in other organizations. And we work as a team. And we go there and make a diagnosis and see what we've got and how we can apply it and try to solve the problem. Many times we recommend that your next step is to hire a PA. You can't afford another MD, but you can afford a PA. And we recommend that often. And there are some situations in the state, and I'll mention this one because I think this is going to occur more often. And actually this one didn't work out, but this is what we recommended. Two older doctors, 60 and 70 years of age, who have been in this town for 20 and 30 years. They have been trying for years to recruit partners, and they've recruited five or six. But for various reasons, mostly lifestyle, they've not been able to hold on to these people. They've come there and they spent 1 or 2 years, and the wife is not happy, or the younger physician is having to work too often. Well, it looked for a while as though we were not going to be able to get medical practitioners there to work with these two guys. And our recommendation was that they hire four PAs. They had one, but they were not using this one correctly. So we counseled them about that. And it was our recommendation that they hire four. And the four PAs would work a regular schedule, the same as the doctors had been working. The doctors had been working every other night, taking lots of calls, killing themselves at the ages of 60 and 70. And they couldn't take it anymore. Well, our idea was that hire four PAs and let them work every fortnight, and you are working every other night as backup for them. The only reason you are called is if it is something that exceeds their skill. Well, they looked at that for a while, and they were ready to do it, but we finally hit a bonanza some other place, and they got medical partners. But they still hired other PAs, and those are working well. But I think the PA is a more flexible part of the system than the physician many times, and can be placed when the doctor can't be afforded.
Flexible in what sense?
They can work in a hospital. They can work in an outpatient clinic. They can work by themselves. They can work in an office with a doctor. There are more of them. You can get two for the price of one doctor. It can just cover more hours. It can cover more. The other situation is the situation where we've got a widely separated county. Let's say we've got a county seat in the middle with 10,000 people, and we've got two or three towns of 1,000 people each. Well, a PA can staff one of those towns as a peripheral site. The doctor coming there maybe twice a week, but the PA is there all the time. That's feasible. They can, with a hub-and-spoke system, they can close, except for the central hub at night and on weekends, they can close all the spokes and contract to the hub on holidays, so that everybody knows where they can get care, 10 miles away. But 5 days a week, or 6 days a week, there's a PA in my local community that I can go to. That's a pretty flexible system. And you can have four or five doctors working in that central location, maybe in a community hospital, doing the hospitalizations for the whole system, doing the consultations for the whole system, doing the supervision for all of these outlying places.
Now, our current PA training programs are designed to produce this kind of a PA who can work at the spoke. No, I guess at the, not the spoke, but at the satellite.
Yeah, that's a spoke.
deal with the full range of...
That's the weather alert. That's a thunderstorm.
Oh, okay. So I thought maybe it was a roll call. Did you have to go to?
No, it's the weather. It's the NOAA weather alert.
Oh, my.
And it scares the hell out of me. It's one we bought since tornadoes have been prevalent.
So now this tells us that one is...
There's a thunderstorm in the 4 or 5 county area somewhere that is noteworthy. But it's, I think it would be rumbling if it were close by.
Right. Okay, the question I have is, I guess, to what degree are PAs graduating from programs that can handle a whole smorgasbord, or how do you deal with that situation?
Okay, now that's an important topic, because I don't think that most people understand that all PAs are trained to be generous. Now, there are a couple of exceptions to that statement. There are a couple of surgical PA training programs, one at Alabama and one other place. But those programs are so close to the generalist program that they make it past the accreditation without any difficulty. But all the programs are set up to train people generally. And I now go back to the Bowman Gray plan, which I want to give credit to. Because Bowman Gray said, okay, now generalist physician, the operating plan here should be that they are trained to do what most people need. So let's take the top 100 conditions that come into primary care physicians' offices, and let's train all PAs to do those 100 things. So they designed a curriculum based on the 100 most commonly encountered problems. Now that's still going on. I think that's the right and proper thing to do. I wish medical schools did. The specialty can come later, but all PAs are trained as generalists in the sense that they're trained to do the 100 most common things. Now, when they finish, they're not finished clinicians. And back to the program I interjected a minute ago. The idea was that every physician hiring a PA was going to spend the first couple of years teaching that person how he wanted to do things. But that aspect is being left in the economic wake now. And that's what's necessary to replace, I think, by some additional clinical training. Now, to give the PA training program some credit, PAs are trained at least 9 months, and most of them it's 12 and 15 months, in a clinical setting doing things, and they have an awful lot of hours under their belt when they leave. Far more than nurse practitioners, by the way. They are experienced clinicians, comparatively, but still not to the extent that a doctor would be after 3 years of residency, for example. That's what the residency does for the physician. The PA doesn't have that in a standard program, but I think it's going to be a requirement in the future. But every PA is technically a generalist. But they're not trained to be omnipotent. They can't cover every detail. They've got to have some additional seasoning and training.
Let's look at it from the other perspective. To what extent are doctors in a program like here at Duke prepared for dealing with PAs when they get out in their own practice?
Another important question, because they many times are not. And Gene Stad said from the beginning, it is as much an educational process for the doctor as it is for the PA. The doctor must explore what that person knows as an individual, because no two PAs are alike either. He must know the personality, he must know the strengths, the weaknesses, the preferences. All of that's a part of the doctor's learning process. He must validate all of those skills and be sure that he wants his patients to be subjected to that. I think that in many medical schools, medical students are trained with PAs, and I think that's good. Most medical students know what a PA is. Most residents know what a PA is. And at Duke, at least, every department has a whole bunch of PAs around, and many of those PAs actually teach MDs about specific things. They may be very specialized and very esoteric things, but they nevertheless are quite good. But the doctor's got to learn what the PA, and I don't think most doctors are trained about two or three aspects of the job. One of them is their responsibility. Everything that I do and everything that PA does, I'm responsible for. It is my responsibility to know what that PA is capable of and is doing. Now, that's quickly overcome in most office practices, because the doctor learns that PA does a damn good job. May do it better than I do it. And there are lots of offices that delegate all the surgery, for example, to the PA, because the PA does it better. Doctors need to know that it's their responsibility. They need to know that it's their responsibility to check the skills of the PA. It's their responsibility to validate it, and it's their responsibility to delegate it, and to let them fly. And I don't think that's done well. There are a lot of doctors who pick that up very quickly because they recognize that this individual can do as well as they can. And you can point to offices all over the state where PAs are working very effectively, and the doctors trust them, they give them lots of responsibility, and they wouldn't do without them.
Okay, we've gone from Dr. Stead coming across the street and saying, hey, I have an idea you might be interested in, to you being the Justice of the Peace traveling around North Carolina, putting water on fires.
Yeah.
Okay. Is there anything major that we have not touched on over that period before I go back and ask you some follow-up questions of my own?
Don't believe so. None that I recall at the
moment. Where I'd like to pick up the thread is with your becoming the chair of the Department of Community and Family.
Yeah, Family.
Right. When you did that, was that an emerging field, or was that already well established and you were just plugging into something there that you knew all the ropes? That was also
brand new.
Brand new. Okay, talk about that.
And naive. And in retrospect, I learned some politics that I didn't know before I went in. Back in 1964 and 1965, there was a growing movement in the country called family practice. Duke didn't have family practice. There was a faculty member, though, who attached himself to some of the early leaders in the field, and they were in this state. And I'll mention a name because it's an important name. Bill DeMaria, D-E-M-A-R-I-A. Bill DeMaria was a pediatrician on the faculty at Duke. Bill was the pediatrician for most of the medical staff. I mean, everybody's kids went to Bill. He was the doctor's doctor. Bill DiMaria became enamored of family medicine, and he said, well, family medicine is coming, and we'd better prepare for it, and we'd better adopt it. And Bill went about the medical school asking other people to help him get that started. They had a proposal, and he went to a member of the Department of Medicine and got an OI, an infectious disease expert named D.T. Smith. And they began to petition the dean for Department of Family Practice. Well, the dean was a surgeon, didn't know quite how to do this, didn't know whether it was an important thing or not, so he did what any dean does, appointed a faculty committee to study it. Well, he put an obstetrician in charge, and they formed a program to study family medicine. And they quickly deduced that the major problem, major impetus for the formation of family medicine was the lack of doctors in many communities. The primary care physician in many small communities was gone. So the problem was really the community that was demanding a replacement for somebody that could no longer be replaced. So the committee came up with the notion of starting a department of community medicine. The problem is not training a generalist physician, the problem is the community. So I was asked to head the department to use economics, to use PAs, to use computers, to use any other thing that would help bring medical care to the community in a more economic. I took the job on the recommendation of Gene Steady. He called me and said, I think this is a challenging area, and I think you'd do well in it, and the committee would like to offer you the position as the first chair of this new department. Well, I took the job. Meager budget, meager office space, almost no facilities, and immediately they began to toss everything that nobody else wanted into that department. So I had to fight off a lot of things. But it became as apparent as the nose on your face that there was a need for a generalist physician, that we were not producing that new kind of breed. And no matter, we worked very hard on computer-based medical care, telemedicine. We had telemedicine back then before it was even thought of. We had self-administered medical histories and computer-based medical care, and we sent faculty members to work with IBM in New York in 1970 to put together computer-based medical records. We had a division of computer medicine by 1970. Well, but it was also apparent that there was a very crucial missing piece, and that was a generalist physician. So we began to petition for a new family medicine program. Well, I didn't know it when I went in, but in effect, our new program was proposed by that faculty member as a means of fighting off Bill DiMaria's eye of family medicine. And there I was, coming back 4 years later, proposing family medicine within that new department. And by 1972, we had a department of family medicine, a division of family medicine within our department, and the name changed to Community and Family Medicine. But the family medicine department was at the community hospital, not at Duke. Duke continued to hold off family medicine until the 1990s. And that's another chapter. That's why I left my chair. Duke, family medicine did well. Family medicine quickly rose to be the largest provider of care under the early aging old plans in this state. And by virtue of that, they began to take patients away from the mother house to the community hospital. Well, two other departments, like medicine and surgery, began to promote doing away with the department because it was competing with them. And the dean appointed an external study by Lewin and Company in Washington to come into the state and look at the state, the need, the local environment, and to advise. And he advised that they swallow hard and say family medicine is part of us, and we're going to bring it back into the university and make it work for us instead of against us. But they elected not to do that and announced, to my utter dismay, in 1985, on May 5th, that they were going to eliminate family medicine from the department, and it was going to be community and family medicine, I mean community and health sciences again. And at which point I announced my resignation from the chair and my determination to fight it. Well, it didn't last long. By June, they had to take it back. And family medicine is now a full partner at the university hospital and running most of the stuff that's really important, like getting out into other communities. But there are still some departments that don't know its importance. But things have changed quite a bit. But the price for me was giving up the chairmanship and fighting it from outside. And fortunately, fighting it effectively and fighting it at a political level in the state. We got 300-400 letters and from all over the country and pointing out that we'll never send you another patient. it worked. So they didn't realize that they were dependent on that, and that they super specialty orientation depended on a broad base of primary care.
So you were being a pathfinder in that area as well as in the in the PA.
Yep.
So why do you give all the credit for creativity to Dr. Stead?
Well, the departments had we had five divisions. All of them, I think, are very good divisions, and all of them have been successful. PA program, family medicine. We had an occupational medicine division, which went out and did occupational medicine all over the state, still does. And we had a division of medical informatics, computers, medical information. We have had our own computer-based system since the 1960s. we had a strange division, which was our moneymaker, a division of the Diet and Fitness Center, which very successful, operated and still operates.
Diet
and Fitness. It brings people in who have a weight problem and treats them very intensively and very well. The best medical care, the best psychological care, the best training. They're trained to shop. They're trained to have an exercise program to go with it. They come here and stay for periods of 2 months and lose 50 pounds while they're at it. But it also makes money, and it produces $1 million a year for the department. The Department of Medicine, our competitive department, my own department, Dr. Stead's own department, started one at the same time, but based on rehabilitation of cardiac patients. That program has lost money, and ours has made money. Ours has been pristine, pure, weight loss. And ours has made $1 million a year, theirs has lost money.
How many of these five divisions existed when you took over the chairmanship?
None. I had one desk, one secretary, and $50,000 a year for my salary. And
so what, in the expectations of the authorities, what were you supposed to do?
That's...
Go to lunch with a secretary every day?
And that was my point. My objective was to build and to solve. And in 1985, the solution was build family medicine, build primary care, build informatics, build occupational medicine, which we did. And the success of the family medicine program in the managed care business led to that attempt to extrude us because we were a bit early.
And in these other areas, you didn't have models to build on much either.
No. Well, I think the department's done well. The department's grown steadily. My second in command took over when I resigned, and everything went merrily on. They made some mistakes that 10 years later are having to be redone. We started a very cooperative program with the county hospital. Right after I left the chair, two departments decided to sever the relationship, which was very warm and very firm, over an issue that was political. They decreed that there should be no cardiac surgery at the county hospital. We want all that back home. And if you start a cardiac surgery program, we're going to withdraw our medical and our surgical residents. They did, and they withdrew. And a month ago, Duke took over the responsibility for running the community hospital. Now we've got to go back and reestablish what we could have had for free 10 years ago.
Now, during this period of time that you were involved in, I would assume, a lot of administrative responsibility and pedagogical, were you also continuing your own research or areas of professional activity or not?
Very little in the way of some clinical research. I continued clinical research for about 20 years after I took over the department. What I took up was working with a very good pathologist who was doing stuff that could be done of a non-clinical sort. Most of my time was I'd devote one half, Saturday mornings were research time. And I would go over and spend time with Don Hackle. And we did work with coronary circulation, which could be done in a laboratory. But I've done no research with patients since I became chair in 1966.
Were you aware that Robert Young died, I guess, yesterday?
No.
Who used to play Marcus Welby, MD, on television. And I just heard that on the radio this morning. And just for the record here, and for my own information, distinguish between the family medicine practice as you were teaching it and the old family doctor model, which you mentioned right at the very beginning in terms of the man in town.
The concept of family medicine came out of some studies that were done in the mid-60s, at about the same time as the PA program started. For the same reason, by the way, inability to supply doctors to underserved communities. It was clearly recognized that the old pattern, by the way, the old pattern was 4 years of medical school and 1 year of internship, spent in four rotations, surgery, pediatrics, OB, and medicine. That was the old pattern. The residency tradition didn't start until after World War II, when people started coming back from overseas. There were specialists before World War II, but very few. After World War II, the old internship disappeared and merged into the residency. Well, by 1966, the pattern was clearly established that the residency for 3 years, 4 years, 5 years was the pattern, not rotating internship. Well, we need a generalist physician. The generalist physician should train no less than the generalist internist and the general pediatrician and the general surgeon. So let's make the training 3 years. The rotation is through medicine, through pediatrics, through psychiatry, through emergency room, some formal 3 years of experience in something that looked like a doctor's office. The distinguishing feature was the fact that there was a model family practice clinic, and the faculty ran a clinic, an outpatient clinic, and took care of a population of patients, and the resident worked with the faculty as an outpatient physician, and in addition, rotated through inpatient experience in medicine, pediatrics, OB, so forth and so forth. Well, that pattern was established in 1966, and we were one of the first departments to start a department of family practice. Ours started in 72. That's what Bill DeMary wanted the school to do in 1966.
In 1966, I was in Berkeley, California, trying to understand the hippie movement.
Yep.
And to what extent did that spirit of the times impact on you all here, or wasn't that an issue?
Yes, it was an issue. For example, I was on the academic faculty council at that time, as part of what many places is called academic senate or whatever. And the students invaded the president's home and captured the registrar in his office and tried to burn the records and things of that sort. And yes, there was ferment, a lot of it. And Terry Sanford was brought in as president about that time, with a background as a paratrooper and a governor and an FBI agent, and quite skillful in dealing with students and sort of stayed the Philistines at the door. But yes, that was a very much a part of the campus environment, not very much in the medical school, very little in the medical school.
Now, in my experience at Berkeley, a lot of my colleagues became attracted to the Peace Corps as one way of expressing social conscience and whatnot. Now, I would think the kinds of programs that you were heading out would have the same kind of appeal.
Family medicine has many roots of that sort, but these were the young people who went into family medicine at the beginning were largely the rebels who were reacting against becoming a left toe specialist or an iris specialist or a left eardrum specialist, a whole person. We embraced women. In fact, one year, 11 of 13 of our residents were women. Didn't have to dress to the teeth and, you know, a lot of stuff. It was very similar to the Peace Corps and a lot of that stuff in there along with it. And we viewed ourselves in somewhat the same way as the blacks at the same time, you know. Nobody liked family medicine. It was over there in the outhouse, and nobody allowed us to come in the big house and do things. To get family doctors admitted to the county hospital to do OB, for example, was kind of big because the obstetricians wouldn't let us in. Had to fight. Everything was a fight. The surgeons didn't like us to learn to do surgery. The medicine people didn't like us to learn to listen to hearts. Had to fight to get in. Usually by finding one or two people that would do it. And very much of that sort of feeling at the same time.
So in a way, you have been a professional rebel.
Sort of. Not in the sense of getting a gun and going to the door, but in a much more subtle way of injecting change into the system and watching and feeling the change and watching the change the system.
And do you feel you took some heavy hits because of that within the university or within the profession?
Yeah. To be booted out of your department, it was pretty heavy stuff. There's one other incident I want to tell you about because I think it's highly significant. This was 1967, very early, before family medicine. One of our first efforts was to say the secret of getting out into communities is to form group practices. Group practices, where you can bring a critical mass of internists and pediatricians and obstetricians and surgeons together. To do that, we wanted to form in this community of Durham a model group practice that could be used to train people to work together with pediatricians and internists and obstetricians. We recruited a group of three internists, to be the first physicians to start this. We got some money to start it. We got a building, and the building was a leased building that was built by an entrepreneur here in town for our purposes. The first objection we had was from members of my own Department of Medicine who said, "You're hiring three of our trainees to go into town and compete with us." And they went to the dean to ask him to forbid us to do this. And he came to me to say, "What are you going to do about this? You've got members of a very strong department," who had convinced Jim Weingarten. Jim Weingarten was Gene Stead's chief, to take this cause and take it to the dean. Well, what do I do about that? Here's the most powerful department in the school, and we're the youngest department. We didn't have the three people, and they were the three people that were going to do this. And they were going to forbid us from doing it. Well, I got on a plane from Washington, D.C. back to Durham and happened to sit next to Evelyn Stead, who you'll meet tomorrow. Evelyn Stead said, "Well, you know, Gene is coming home tonight." This was a Friday night. "And he'll be here tomorrow." And they would have an extraordinary meeting of the Medical Private Diagnostic Clinic on Sunday morning at 9 o'clock, where they would consider this issue, and we were to make our case to the Department of Medicine as to why we should be allowed to do this. And she said, "I'm going to tell Gene about this, and he'll call you when he gets here." And he did. I told him what was up, and he says, "I'll come with you on Sunday morning." Nobody expected him. And here was the old man, the chief, that everybody owed their job to and everybody looked up to. He came in, and he said, "Let me handle it." And he stood up, and he says, "How dare you? The newest department, your own trainees, they have nothing but not even a pot to pee on. And you've got all these resources, and you've got all of these specialties. And you're going to tell them that they are doing an unfair thing by competing with you, who is so well established, and all of you are renowned in your own fields and so forth. How dare you say that to them?" And they voted to let it pass and to approve it. Well, Gene Stead has helped me at some critical times. It would have never passed had he not gotten up and said that.
He did have clout.
He had clout. So, tells you why I'm so fond of that guy. And there are other times, too. Politically and otherwise.
I want to just go through and a few quick questions. You got your BA at Emory as well as...
Yep.
And that was in biology, or...
It was in pre-medical sciences, sort of biologic things.
There's no order to this. When you were... let me stop and take a moment.